KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I think about the Dewey Decimal System. I do not have a good experience with e-readers. I do not enjoy reading e-books.
I think that they should acknowledge this newfound right. I think they should celebrate in the privacy of their homes. If they choose to do so, and be thankful that we are no longer arresting some 10,000 Washingtonians a year.
Nancy Pearl is going to be here to talk about her experience with books this year, give us some of the best of the year, and talk about some great gifts. That's coming up. First, we're going to talk about pot and the changes coming to our state when marijuana becomes legal on December 6th in Washington State, and what that will mean day to day, and how the feds may just be reacting. Dr. Thomas McClellan is former deputy director of drug policy in the Obama administration. We're going to continue to talk about the changes that are coming to our state with changes in the law. We start with marijuana today. Dr. McClellan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think legalization might actually mean at the day-to-day level from your experience looking at this?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not likely to happen, despite the state passage of these laws. But if it were to happen,
you think December 6th, Thursday, is going to come around, and then something the feds will step in?
That would be my expectation, and I'll tell you why. It has very little to do with ideology or any of the political posturing. It's like changing. It's like if Oregon decided they wanted to have different naturalization and immunization practices, it would put the whole federal government into conflict with international policies. There are 8 international policies that govern all controlled substances, and states really don't have the authority to declare that it's legal.
That's now, interesting. So they've been very quiet, the feds, so far.
They've been very quiet. So it becomes an issue of enforcement. To what extent, how much? You see a glimmer of it with so-called medical marijuana, that the feds have the option to enforce that. DEA, FDA could enforce that. They've chosen not to so far. We will see. But if you want my opinion, I think the kinds of issues that any state, Oregon or any other, will have to deal with are best seen in the already legal medications or drugs that are out there: alcohol, cigarettes, and most recently prescription opiates.
You mean that it's regulated, it's controlled, and there's a system in place by which you can access these?
Yes. For example, I think a very reasonable example would be cigarettes. It's perfectly permissible for any Oregonian to grow their own tobacco plants, use hydroponic soil, etc., roll them, etc. But in fact, because of legalization, it's just a lot more efficient and it's a lot easier, better access, everything else, to simply go to the store and buy a package of pre-rolled plant material wrapped up in paper. It's called a cigarette.
But, you know, in Washington State, do you expect cigarette companies to get involved in selling marijuana cigarettes? They're still prevented, aren't they?
So what do you imagine will prevent? Do you think there's going to be a lot of profit in selling marijuana? I do. So what do you think will prevent a cigarette manufacturer or any other legitimate business from getting into it? If you imagine that Amish farmers are going to be the ones selling marijuana, I don't think that's going to happen.
So you do envision the idea being, if legalization takes place, Colorado proceeds, if Washington State proceeds, that at some point the bigger players are going to move in, just the way they have in alcohol when the state regulation
absolutely.
Of alcohol went away.
Absolutely. And then other things will occur, and it will be we will see whether it's worth it. There will be immediate benefits to reducing some of the incarceration costs that have been associated with marijuana use. I presume it will still be illegal to for people who don't have a license to sell it. That it remains to be determined, but that will be one. And then there should be taxes that will accrue, and that should help the state's budget quite a bit. On the other hand, there are, you can imagine there are going to be new expenses. I'm guessing that no state wants this to be freely, easily available to kids. Now, you might say, well, kids use it anyway. Well, if you increase the access, affordability, ease of to obtain it, more kids are going to have access. So I'm assuming you're going to put some dollars into more kind of an enforcement there. If you make it legal, you're going to assume some responsibility from the potency, the purity, the ingredients in whatever is manufactured of and sold. And just as happened with cigarettes, you're going to have companies that will infuse marijuana with greater amounts of THC or other cannabinoids. That's going to require some policing. You know, and the list goes on.
You looked at drunk driving impacts in as part of the Office of Drug Policy. Do you have a sense of how the drug driving regulations will be enforced in the states that have tried to legalize marijuana?
Well, there's already efforts to try to do that because it's a significant problem. I don't think it's as severe as drunk driving. But there's no reason to imagine that it's going to be marijuana instead of alcohol or marijuana instead of cocaine. It'd probably be in addition. When the feds have looked at this in random stops without they haven't pulled people over because they've been swerving or running through a stoplight, just random stops in hours between 10 o'clock and 1 o'clock in the Friday and Saturday nights, you find 9% of drivers who have marijuana on, have used marijuana in the last 3 hours. That from a cheek swab that has a good detection rate for a 3 hour window.
You know, the complaint about this law when before it was passed was that the standard that that drivers who are pulled over will be judged on is very low in terms of impairment and in terms of how much marijuana stays in your system.
Right.
What's the way to determine if a person's really impaired, which is the question, from marijuana?
Right. There are ways to do this, and it has been done for alcohol. Now, the advantage of being able to do it for alcohol is that you can deliver known quantities and known potencies of alcohol, and you can assay that by urine, breath, sweat, cheek swab. And after a lot of testing, you find that alcohol at anything above very small amounts impairs driving. There's been the agreement to make a cutoff at 0.08, but that's after decades of research. That could be done with marijuana as well. It would take probably the same amount of time, except that it's hard to tell what kind of potency you're going to be. If a consumer is going to be using marijuana, they know, for example, that more than two or three drinks is going to put them at risk if you're, you know, an average-sized male or female person of drinking age. They don't know that about a joint. They won't know how much of which cannabinoids are in that material, and therefore they won't have that kind of information. But, you know, I could go through the technical aspects of this for quite a while till your readers turn to the rock music stations. But I just ask this. Is there anybody that thinks marijuana is going to improve somebody's driving? How about marijuana plus alcohol? Is there a good reason to imagine it's going to improve driving out there? I find that hard to believe.
So what's the implication? What are you saying with that question?
I would favor low rates of blood alcohol, THC, or other cannabinoid as a threshold for an arrest. And if you ask me, I would favor the same kinds of sanctions that are presently used in alcohol.
But hasn't the problem been that people are saying, look, there's this residue shows up in your blood, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're at the level of impairment that you would have been when you first took it?
Exactly right. And that it is not known. I can't tell you at what blood level you're going to have impairment. And I'm further stipulating it's going to take a decade to get that right. But my point to you is, what do the citizens of your state want? Do they want to go to that decade's worth of work, or are they willing to say, you know, actually, I'd rather have people not using alcohol or other drugs or even prescribed medications in a way that's going to interfere? So that'll have to be a policy determination, excuse me, and that's one of the things you're going to have to deal with if marijuana becomes more freely available.
Well, let me ask you, well, and clearly the voters have decided they like the law enough to vote for it, the law they read,
yep,
with those restrictions. Let me ask you this last question here. You worked in the Office of National Drug Control Policy. You have the Treatment Research Institute where you're working on substance abuse as,
yep,
research. What do you know about marijuana now that would either have you want to see it changed as a classified drug or remain where it is in its classification?
So you saved the easy question for last, did you? Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. These are my opinions. First, I do not favor legalization of marijuana. Not because, for ideological reasons, I don't favor it because I don't think we need any new drugs. Legalization increases access, availability, and therefore use of whatever you get legalized. I don't want to see a lot more people smoking dope. And I'm not a prude. It's not for that reason. If I know that kids aren't graduating and we're facing an increasingly competitive world, the answer to improving that is not making marijuana more freely available. So that's point one. Point two, I know that today's marijuana, and this is not an opinion, it's a fact, today's marijuana is far different from the marijuana that has been used in the past. Some of the synthetic marijuanas that are available, the cannabidiol and cannabinoids that you can spray on plant material, can be as high as 600 times more potent than available, the natural marijuana. It is unknown what that level of potency will do for driving, for concentration, for the ability to learn, and that's in adults. For developing brains, it's really questionable.
Let me ask you something, Thomas McClellan. Do you think these are the conversations and these are the arguments that are being made in the Office of National Drug Control Policy today and tomorrow?
I know that they are. I know that the current administration has taken this very seriously. And I've been out of office for a year, so I'm not giving you a political comment here. I know that this is going on. And I know that there are equally serious and avoidable problems of over-incarceration for people who have been locked up because of use. That is stupid. It is stupid. It is wasteful. It's expensive. But there's something between incarcerating people who smoke marijuana and making it legal and therefore more available that I think needs to be developed. And I like the conversation and the fact that your station has taken this up.
Well, we'll see what happens on the 6th. And, yeah, the conversation will continue. Thomas McClellan is CEO and co-founder of the Treatment Research Institute. He was deputy director at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy in the Obama-Biden administration. Thank you, sir.
You bet.
This is Weekday.
Coming up, Nancy Pearl tells us about her favorite books of the year. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Facheri Jewelry Art Gallery, offering jewelry as art by more than 50 artists, and antique and vintage jewelry located in downtown Seattle between Pike and Union inside City Center, and on the web at facerejewelryart.com.
We have clouds and rain, 49 degrees in the University District, working towards a high of 50 today. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of today, tonight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the mid-40s, tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
You are Nancy Pearl. That's who you are, Nancy Pearl. And she is here to talk with us. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here.
Nancy Pearl, author of Book Lust, Book Crush.
All right, let's not use up all the time. Let's talk about some good books, too.
We just have to let people know who you are.
I know. I'm sorry.
You are not that famous.
I know. Sorry.
You are the NPR Morning Edition, Nancy.
It's embarrassing to hear.
And I enjoy embarrassing you. Nancy, I was looking at all, like the New York Times Review had their best books. I was looking at Publishers Weekly. I was looking at, I think, the LA Times. There are many books that have come out in 2012 that I do not know anything about. And I like to think that I know. But there have been a lot of great books this year.
Well, as to paraphrase Shakespeare, there are more books, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your bookstore.
All right. Well, let's talk about Should we go by fiction, nonfiction, or just general?
Why don't we?
How do you like to break it up?
We could just go by general.
All right. So then, if I may, we're going to talk a little bit later about some books perhaps you want to give to your loved ones.
Or those,
it's the giving season.
Or those you sort of feel you need to give a gift to.
Right.
But
perhaps
you don't quite know what they would want.
Perhaps you have some suggestions for our previous guest, the books he should read. What's at the top of your list for a book that you want us to think about?
Well, for nonfiction, the top of my list is Tim Kreider's collection called We Learn Nothing, Essays and Cartoons. I think not enough people know about this book, and it is a fabulous collection of personal essays by a guy who was a political cartoonist all during the Bush years and has segued now into essay writing. And there, even though he's a totally different demographic than I am, there was something in every one of these essays that I would say, wow, that's just how I feel. And the essays range from everything from how hard it is to be grateful for your life every moment of the day, even after you've had a close-to-death experience. This guy, Tim Kreider, was stabbed in the throat with a stiletto on vacation, and it missed his carotid artery by, under an inch. And he thought after that, knowing that he might have died, he would be grateful for the rest of his life for being alive, and how hard it is to do that, to a visit to a Tea Party rally that he and a friend did, to a wonderful section of reading out loud Tristram Shandy to his mother. And I could never make it through Tristram Shandy, even as an English major. But reading what Tim Kreider says about the book, the way he describes it and the way he says that Lawrence Stern, the author of Tristram Shandy, both invented the novel and he both constructed the novel and deconstructed the novel in the same novel. And that novel is Tristram Shandy. So,
wow.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful collection of essays.
Are there cartoons in there too?
Very few cartoons, just little illustrations of cartoons. So I thought that was just fabulous.
All right. NPR put out a list of best books of 2012, the complete list. They asked various different people to put different things, and we'll make sure that's linked, or you can just search best books of 2012. They all come up. But that's not on your list for the omnivorous reader.
Well,
Librarian Nancy Pearl's picks for the omnivorous reader.
It should be.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Third.
Yeah.
It's third.
My goodness.
I
but
bet.
But one of the books that isn't there, because I had already talked about it in a previous Morning Edition segment, was Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which I think is my favorite work of fiction.
I remember
year.
You talking about
yes.
that book.
Yeah, by Ben Fountain.
Yeah.
An amazing, amazing novel.
Billy, is it L-Y-N-N? Lynn?
Yeah, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, about a young young American soldier. He and his squad, Bravo Squad, are brought back from Iraq for a victory tour.
That's
and he has
right.
to go, you know, they're going to go back in 2 weeks. But the book takes place basically on one day, which is Thanksgiving Day, when they're spending it at Texas Stadium as guests of the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. And I mean, the quotations from that book are just, what a great book. It's a first novel. Ben Fountain's in his 50s. It's just oh my.
Well, that's hopeful for the rest of us.
It is. Exactly how I felt.
You buckled down and got to work even more.
Yeah.
More assiduously.
Yeah. We all should do that.
All right. I'm going to do that.
Okay.
All right.
If you do it, I'll do it.
I got the plan. Good. I'm making a plan
okay.
right now.
I got a plan, too.
What else?
Tim Weiner's Enemies, A History of the FBI, which is Tim Weiner did last year, a couple years ago, did one on the CIA. And the CIA one was just fascinating. Well, I think reading about the CIA is just really interesting. And certainly there's been a lot more written probably on the FBI. But Tim Weiner's book, for anyone who's interested in both history and I think in current events, Weiner is a writer to read when you're thinking about either the FBI or the CIA. So that was another good one. Will Schwab's The End of Your Life Book Club. Now, that's such a hokey, you know, when I saw that title, when I got a copy of that book, I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to read this book. I hate being manipulated. I hate that feeling of the author, you know, sort of making you, you know, sort of giving you a subject that you're going to just weep over. I hate that feeling. And that sort of mawkish sentimentality that shows up in books like this. Which and I just avoid them, but this book.
Why did you expect that mawkish sentimentality?
Well, the end of your life book club.
I see. That's, you know, the whole.
How could
the
it
whole
be, yeah. Yeah. How could it be anything but that? But it is. It's just again maybe, you know, one of my top 10 books of the year. But
really,
yes.
Katie talked to that author.
Yeah, she did.
She really liked it.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. I remember when Katie said that to me. It's just a book that. It's a wonder. It's not even the book's part that I liked best about this book. You know, the books that he and his mother choose to read as she's getting her radiation and chemotherapy treatments for a very fast moving, lethal form of cancer. But it's really a tribute to his mother, who was seemingly just a wonderful person concerned with. Issues of immigration. The last thing that she did before she died was make sure that these libraries were being built in Afghanistan, raising money for that. I mean, she's the kind of woman that I remember. I just felt like I wanted to either, I wished that I had a mother like that, or that I was a mother like that, a woman like that. She's just an amazing person. So, you know, this is a book I would say I wish they had chosen a different title. I don't know that there is a better title that I could come up with, but a fabulous, fabulous book.
That's great. All right. Now, I'm going to bounce back and forth because
okay.
I'm curious about
good.
This. So here's a Slate's
oh, yeah.
list of their best books of 2012. And I was wondering if, for example, their top one, I assume it's their top one, maybe not, Young House Love, 243 Ways to Paint, Craft, Update, and Show Your Home Some Love.
I know.
It's the top of their list. I don't know if it's their favorite one. It's their designer chose it, so maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Ever heard of that book?
No.
How about?
But that's not my feel.
How about How Children Succeed by Paul Tough? The Emily Bazelon, who's their senior editor, chose that as one. An education writer, Paul Tough goes deeper than anyone I know, she says. I'm just throwing these out there because
yeah,
I find this interesting. Well, here's Andy Bowers chose, who was the executive producer of their podcast, used to be an NPR reporter, chose The Man Without a Face by Mesha Gessen about Vladimir Putin.
Well, yeah.
There you go. I'm just tossing them out.
Well, there's something for everybody.
Something for everyone. All right. And look, somebody liked their columnist, Simon Doonan, liked Martin Amis's book, Lionel Asbo, State of England.
That's interesting. I mean,
I read that book.
Oh, you did?
I interviewed Martin Amis for that.
You did?
I don't know if I'd call that one of my...
your top books.
I don't know if I'd call it Martin Amis's latest chuckle fest, a fabulous and much-needed antidote to the twee downtown Abbey view of England. Well, that's true. That's how this writer put it.
Steve, you and I always have a chuckle fest on this when we're on the show, when I'm on this show with you.
We are lower and trashier than any Cardassian or Jersey Shore habitué. That's what we learn about the Brits in that book. That's what this person says. Do you have Nicholson Baker's book?
No.
On your list, The Way the World Works?
No.
Writing on Wikipedia is like John Updike on Ted Williams or James Baldwin on Going to Church in Harlem, a perfect match of subject, mind, and matter. There you go. Okay, I'm just throwing out a few. I'm going to go to some other lists too.
I'd love to hear about what people think.
What else do you have on your list of best books of 2012, Nancy Pearl?
Well, one of the books that's on my list is Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth, which
really?
Is his brand new book, and I would not call myself a devoted fan of Ian McEwan. I kind of pick and choose what I liked and didn't like, but I thought this book was brilliant.
Really?
Was brilliant.
What was Sweet Tooth about?
Sweet Tooth is about a young woman who's recruited by MI5, and in the course of that, of her work for the MI5, she meets a writer who MI5 is going to subsidize because they want. This is set in the 50s, and so it's winning the hearts and minds of the British people away from communism.
Ah,
but the construction is brilliant.
In what way?
Well, it's one of those books that again, you can't talk too much about. But I have to say that it's the most like. People who read Atonement and you know, that sort of shock when you get to the end of Atonement, there's a similar shock when you get to the end of Sweet Tooth.
Huh. The New York Times likes this book.
That book?
Yeah.
Do they?
Yeah.
What are their five? I haven't read that section.
Not, however, in their list.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
And they're all. The New York Times is... top 10 books of 2012 in this particular list, so it's 5 and 5.
Right. So I bet one is Anne Applebaum's book on the Cold War, the destruction of Eastern Europe.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised, but let's see. Okay. No, not in their top five.
Oh, okay.
No, for their nonfiction, their top five, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Catherine Boo's book about Mumbai Undercity. Did you read that book?
I did read that book.
I like that book.
I like that book, too. It's hard with books like that because I don't know. Evidently, everybody who's read it, most of the people who've read it, believe that it's crossed the line from really superb reportage to something other, deeper.
You don't mean in terms of advocacy, do you?
No. I mean in terms of message and I'm not entirely convinced that it did that for me.
Oh, I see. So that. What would be, is there an example in your mind of a book that has done, that's hard to conjure up out of the blue, but.
I think From Beirut to Jerusalem.
Okay.
The Thomas Friedman book. Which is also now out in a new edition. They bring it out every time something comes up in Israel or in the Middle East. So there's a brand new edition of that. But for me, that moved beyond the reportage to a deeper understanding of the context. And much
sort of reframed it, didn't it?
Reframed it.
It did reframe our thinking about it in the West anyway.
Yes. There's an older title. I'm going to Bosnia.
Are you?
Yes, in the middle of January.
That sounds like the time to go.
I know. Yeah. they said we won't have you fly into Sarajevo because that airport is frequently fogged in. So you'll fly into Zagreb in Croatia and we'll pick you up.
Are you doing some
work?
An event there?
Work. I'm going to work there. Yeah, for the U.S. Embassy. there.
Really?
Yes, they're doing. This is really, I think, pretty amazing that they're sponsoring it. If all Bosnia Herzegovina read the same book, and the book is Sherman Alexie's part-time, you know, the diary of
no
a part-time
kidding.
Indian.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, and I'm going to teach the leaders of the discussion groups how to talk about difficult issues. So Bosnia is much on my mind. And there was an older book by a guy named Peter Maas, M-A-A-S-S, called Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which is about Yugoslavia breaking up. And that's a book that, for me, went beyond reporting.
Interesting. You know? All right, that's good.
And Richard Reichardt, you know, Kapuscinski, do you remember Kapuscinski?
Oh.
The Polish writer who, you know, just traveled everywhere.
I don't remember that. I don't know that book, but we'll look
okay.
it up.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to spell his
name. All right, so here's the other ones they had. So and then I want to get yours. Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You read that one?
No, I haven't read that one. I did love his book, The Noonday. Well, it's hard to say you love it, but I did think his book, The Noonday Demon, about depression, was just wonderful.
Andrew Solomon. I think he was on a conversation a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, wouldn't be surprised.
The Passage of Power, Robert Caro's book.
Yeah, it's hard not to. Yes.
That's a pretty remarkable book.
Oh, gosh.
I still remain in awe and a little bit concerned by a guy who can spend so many years with one person.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe he's got really good something in his brain where he can really divide it well. The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. Did you read that?
I didn't read that.
David Nassau.
I'm going to have to read it.
And why?
Because it's one of the ones that's going to be on our long list for the Carnegie Award.
Oh, yeah. And what about Why Does the World Exist, an existential detective story?
I have that at home, and I can't wait to read that.
For several centuries now, thinkers have wondered, why is there something rather than nothing? In search of an answer, Jim Holt takes the reader on a witty and erudite journey from London to Paris to Austin, Texas. That sounds good.
It sounds great.
What else is on your nonfiction list?
On my nonfiction? No, I said all the nonfiction.
Oh.
I thought this was not a great year for nonfiction.
Really?
A much better year for fiction.
Wow.
Fiction,
there's going to be some throwdown from you.
I know.
People agree with that.
Or not.
What other fiction do you have then?
Well, Louise Erdrich's The Roundhouse, which won the National Book Award.
Really?
Yes. This is a sequel of sorts to A Plague of Doves, which came out the year I was a Pulitzer fiction judge. And this was one of our three finalists. The Plague of Doves, and I thought it was certainly one of the top three fiction works for me that year. And again, I am not like this huge, you know, sort of tongue hanging out fan of Louise Erdrich, but this book is just remarkable. It's a wonderful novel.
Can I ask a troubling question?
Yes.
What do we learn about Louise Erdrich and her writing and skill, since for a time Louise Erdrich and Michael Doris tried to work together before he committed suicide? Because she has gone on to write some award-winning books.
Totally. She has. I think that that's going to remain a mystery unless she chooses to speak about it, and I doubt that she will choose to speak about it.
All right. What else do you have on your fiction? That's good. From 2012.
Richard Ford's Canada. Another amazing book. Just an amazing experience. The kind of book that you just read passages and reread them, because he's a wonderful writer. I was surprised this wasn't one of the finalists for the National Book Award.
Well, has he won twice?
For The Sports Writer, that trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But still,
yeah.
This is a different book.
Remind us what Canada was about.
Canada is about, they're all about middle-aged men.
Yes.
A middle-aged man who's looking back on the life of his parents who were, and his experiences with them, and his parents were kind of failed, spectacularly failed bank robbers.
Yeah. Ended up in Canada. He was a 12-year-old when he started the story.
Right.
I mean, the character.
The character, right.
That's right.
Yes.
Thank you. And I interviewed Ford for that. And what I was struck by was how Ford is so immersed isn't even the right word. his character, he can speak of his characters in depth, even though they're his. I mean,
yeah, yes,
they're fictional.
Yes, right. I think the point for Ford is that for the reader, they're not fictional, and so he has to know everything about them, whether or not that particular fact is going to end up in the book. And I think that's the kind of writing that I really like, and I think that he does it remarkably, has always done it remarkably well.
Richard Ford's Canada. What else? I'm going to go through all your before we.
Okay, Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter.
Oh yeah.
You know. Oh my goodness.
Spokane.
I mean, of course, one of my all-time favorite books is Citizen Vince by him, and I still think that would be a great gift to give anybody. But the thing about Jess Walter is his last couple. I mean, he's writing very different books each time, and I just give him enormous credit for that. And Beautiful Ruins is set partially in Italy, partially in Hollywood, the way that the past defines who we are in the present, and yet the differences that it is, and again, just some characters in there that you feel like, oh, they'll be around and they'll hang around in your life forever.
Yeah, yeah, including the woman.
Oh yeah, yes,
the mystery woman,
and then there's just two really little known books. And I don't call my list ever the best books. I call them, these are just my favorites for the year.
And that's better.
And that's better, I think, because best books, that's a hard, I would have a hard time. I couldn't defend any list as best. Lydia Netzer's Shine, Shine, Shine. Oh my gosh, what a wonderful first novel. And it's about a brilliant a guy who is on a space mission. It's set in the present. His wife is pretending that she's this kind of upper middle class woman. And then something happens and all of that gets stripped away. And it's about relationships. Again, it's about the past impinging on the present. It's just wonderful. It has a great cover. Shine, Shine, Shine. Do that one. And then Heft, which is on my list for one of the ones for Morning Edition by Liz Moore. And this is would be a great book club book. All of these would be great for book groups, actually. But a really good question to start with for discussing Liz Moore's Heft, which is now just out in paperback, is what's the significance of the title? Like, why is it Heft? It's true that one of the characters in this book, first character that you meet is this recluse who is morbidly obese. So there's partly the Heft, but what else does Heft mean? So there's that.
That's great. All right.
Okay.
Did you get them all?
That's it. Yeah.
All right. Some of Nancy Pearl's favorite books of 2012 on Weekday on KUOW. I'm going to take a break. I want to come back. People might have some questions for gifts, some other books that are on other people's lists I want to get your opinions of as well. You're listening to Weekday.
Beginning this Thursday, adults over 21 can legally possess marijuana in Washington state. But there's no way to legally buy it except for medical use. Pot remains illegal under federal law, and a federal challenge could stall attempts to sell pot in state-licensed stores. We'll get the full story at noon today.
Support for KUOW comes from HopeLink, each year working to help tens of thousands of people in the community with food, housing, transportation, and job services. More information this holiday season at hope-link.org. Lend a hoping hand.
1965, the mid-60s, but the year that the decade of the 60s became the 60s. Pivoting from Leave It to Beaver to the Jefferson Airplane, historian James T. Patterson on his new book, The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Clouds and rain, 48 degrees in the U District, working towards a high of 50. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of today, tonight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low, 46. Tomorrow's high, 52.
Nancy Pearl is here talking about writing and reading and enjoying the world of literature. You may have some questions for her about what books to give this time of year. And I have some other questions about some other books that have shown up on the list that we're calling favorite books, though if you do the search, it's best books of 2012. But it's really favorite books because, as you said, how can you defend a best books list or best movies? Only if you're willing to have a long conversation about everything.
Yes.
All right, so let me start with a phone call because Vincent's been holding for a little bit. And our number is 206-543-5869. You got some thoughts about books that have come out this year, or ones you want to give. 1-800-289-5869. We got about 6 minutes left on this. Vincent's in Langley. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for holding.
I have a 9-year-old daughter who has just finally found that first set of books that she's been devouring and won't put down, which are the Percy Jackson series of books, which uh-huh. we're very excited about. And she's on the fifth book and finishing, so we're looking for things to get her for Christmas to keep her in that spirit of independent reading. And I know we read together the series of books of the Aragon books, all four of those, 3,000 pages, and she really loved those too. So that fantasy sort of thing is something she enjoys, and she's at that third, fourth grade reading level. So, what would you recommend for her?
Oh gosh, I've been thinking so much about teen books that I have not thought a lot about children's books. But I'll tell you, you have a great library there in Langley, and I would go to the library and talk to the children's librarian there. There are just a ton of good middle grade fantasies out there, and I know I'm like, just this answer is just a cop out. I would think Anthony Horowitz's Stormbreaker. That's a series of, he's kind of a young James Bond, lots of adventures. And
really?
That series begins.
That.
Yeah, it's really good. That series, they're page turners. And the series begins, the first book, I think, which is Stormbreaker, begins when the phone rings at 3 a.m., it's never good news or something, something similar to that. If you want to move away from the fantasy, they're the Alice books. And I'm forgetting who the author is. But there's a whole series of them, and they start when Alice is like in the fifth or sixth. Phyllis Reynolds Naylor, N-A-Y-L-O-R. Those sort of grow up with the reader.
Starting with Alice.
Yeah, starting with Alice.
That's what it's called.
Yeah.
But yes, that's
yes.
The first
and then
book.
She went back and filled in the past, and then did the newer ones, but I would read those not in publication order, but in chronological order, which you could probably find by Googling or the librarian.
I did
be able to.
I did
you.
Books yeah. by Phyllis Reynolds in yeah. chronological order.
Yeah.
That was quick.
Right. Yes. So that's what I would do. And I apologize for not being able to help you anymore.
Well, that's a good start. I appreciate it, Vincent. And it's nice to know Langley has such a good library.
It has. Yeah. Well, it's part of the Snow Isle system, which is a fabulous library system. Plus, on Langley, there's also that very lovely, wonderful independent bookstore with people who have good knowledge about what they can suggest to you.
What were you? What you've been thinking about juvenile fiction? Did you say
teen fiction?
Teen fiction.
Yes.
Just because you like to?
No,
because
I was just on Minnesota Public Radio and we were talking about teen fiction.
Anything jump out from that?
Well, there's one actually that the person that I was on with, who was a youth services librarian or head of youth services at the Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore, just fabulous. So I kept writing down the things that she said. But there's two graphic novels that I want to read. One series called Girl Genius, which I haven't seen. So these are not my recommendations necessarily. Another one, a graphic novel called Smile, about the experience of braces, and then one called Drama that's coming out. So I talked about Codename Verity, I think, the last time we were on. Fault in Our Stars by John Green.
Yeah.
Cassandra Clare, what this Deb Thomas said was her Mortal Instruments, the prequels, I think, to her Mortal Instruments series.
And those are graphic novels? Or those
no,
are,
no, those are regular.
Those are regular novels.
Yes, sorry.
Great, great. I also saw that NPR has, yeah, for their best books, graphic novels that flew under the radar in 2012. Drama is one of them.
Yeah.
It was A Little White Duck, A Childhood in China, and The Crackle of the Frost.
Huh.
We could be very busy.
We could be. We could
be. Be a fine way to be busy. Heidi's in North Seattle. Hi, Heidi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I think I had kind of a similar question. I'm looking for a gift for a 13-year-old boy, and last year I gave him the Underland Chronicles, and he really enjoyed that. But I think he might be a little too young for the Hunger Games.
So that's Gregor. Is that the Gregor one? Gregor,
yeah,
the over. Okay.
Suzanne Collins.
Right. Yeah. That she wrote before she wrote the Hunger Games. A 13-year-old boy, yes. Here's the series, The Maze Runners by James Dashner.
Okay.
Maze, like
M-A-Z-E.
M-A-Z-E.
Yes, that whole series. Hard to find somebody who's not, who wouldn't just really get into that.
Great.
A lot. So that series, and that will keep him busy for quite a while.
Well, that's all you need. Heidi, thanks. And Joan in North Seattle. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Thank you so much for your show.
Thank you.
I have an aunt who has had a stroke and, close to 90, quite depressed, and is like, she says she just wants something to take up time. And I'm trying to think of could you suggest a book that might be helpful for somebody who's very depressed and at the end of her life?
So do you think you would want a novel? I mean, my thinking would go to a light,
yes,
pleasant,
yes,
kind of light, pleasant novel. Okay, so Source Books, this publisher, has reissued all of the Georgette Heyer novels, and I would do any of the Georgette Heyer novels, I think, would fill that. You know, they're just light, they're pleasant, they're fun, they're funny, they're nicely written, but nothing that's going to make you slow down in your reading. So the Georgette Heyer, my favorites are The Grand Sophie, Sylvester, Arabella, but almost any of them I would think would be just great. Sourcebooks has also reissued a book by D.E. Stevenson, and it's called Miss Bunkle's Book, B-U-N-C-L-E apostrophe S, Miss Bunkle's Book. And that, I think, would be another one that would fit that description for you. So I would try those all in paperback.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. By the way, we got an email. Burn This House, The Making and Unmaking of Yugoslavia. My family recently visited Bosnia, Christina says, as well as the Croatian coast. And my dad said that was a good book to read. My dad and I really enjoyed reading up on the building and breakdown of Bosnia by James Ridgway and Jasminka Udovicki.
Oh, good pronunciation. Wow.
Thank you.
I'm impressed.
All right. Any last words about books that you would like to share with us for this incarnation? And the next time you're here, we'll talk about 2013.
Yes, what's coming out. And there's some really good stuff coming out in 2013. Nope, I would just say, if you want good suggestions, go to the library and then make a trip to your local bookstore.
You know, yes, we have to remember our local bookstores and wander in them and talk to those people all the time. Even the used bookstores. Those guys know what's going on, right?
Totally.
Gals.
Totally.
Guys and gals. Why is Snow Isle such a good system? It's well-funded?
It's well-funded, and it's, you know, the director is sort of far-thinking, and they, I've just always been impressed. We're very lucky in our area to have King County, Snow Isle, Seattle Public. I mean, it's a great place for readers.
All right, Nancy Pearl, she is the person who comes in and talks about books with all sorts of people, and we're lucky that she comes in with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, Steve, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You know, throughout this season, we thought we would talk a little bit with some folks who are helping other people for the holidays to remind us all of what to do and how to do it. United Way of King County is going to kick us off. They aim to bring caring people together, giving, volunteering. Michael Beneke is Communications Director at United Way. Hello, Michael.
Steve, how are you? Thanks for having us.
I appreciate you joining us and sort of starting us off for the next few weeks of just talking to various groups who are giving and looking for giving. What do you guys, have a lot of initiatives this time of year. Just go over a few of them.
We do indeed have a lot of initiatives this time of year. You know, as you say, we're driven by the vision that everybody has a role in creating a better community for all of us. And we have many ways to do that, giving, as you say, volunteering, taking action. So take giving as a starting point. Of course, all through the fall, we're doing a lot of workplace campaigns, and people step up extremely generously and in big numbers. And what is always awe-inspiring to us is that those same people, and others as well, also make a point of making a year-end contribution, knowing that there's, you know, some extra good that they could do with that added support. This year we have a theme of Change the Game. It's inspired by our volunteer campaign chairs, the very phenomenal Dan Wilson, the Mariners catcher, of course, and his extraordinary wife, Annie, are the volunteers leading it. And they're urging folks to help change the game for youth and veterans who are experiencing homelessness, to change the game for kids who don't have an equal chance as others, and making a strong start in school. And certainly in making sure that folks are going to have healthy food on the table, and not just at the holidays, but all through the year. You know, there is this beautiful upwelling of generosity and idealism in December. What we know is that the needs are going to continue on into the new year. And in fact, we think that the needs may be even more acute than normal in the new year because of the combination of cuts that people are experiencing in terms of governmental and other sorts of support that were there for nonprofits in the past, and just a continuing high level of need. So it's a great opportunity for people to step up and do a little more and help change the game. There are also a lot of volunteer opportunities that are available here at United Way through the holiday season. You can come to our website, UnitedWayOfKingCounty.org. We have there's lots of actually cool things to do, from organizing entertainment for folks in assisted living or a group home, to holding a coat and shoe drive for a neighborhood shelter. And I should point out that looking again now to the year ahead and sustaining that idealism and generosity, we have again the United Way of King County Martin Luther King Day of Service coming up on January 21st. So what we'd like to encourage people to do is just, you know, do all they can through the season, and then just keep that moving forward into the new year.
I like this one. We have many great initiatives. Adopt a breast cancer survivor. It's one of your holiday initiatives.
Yeah, that's a lovely one. Yeah, and there are literally always hundreds of volunteer opportunities on our website. And I'd like to point out that we are actually in the course of looking for some VISTAs, Volunteers in Service to America. We are actively looking to get some VISTAs involved in our hunger work and our volunteering work, and have a number of opportunities that we're looking to fill right now. So that's another way for people to get involved.
All right. I appreciate it. I appreciate you kicking us off and talking about what you guys are doing.
Yeah, it's fabulous you're doing this. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you. That's Michael Beneke. He's Communications Director, United Way of King County. You can find a link to their work. Well, you know how to find them, but you can also go to KOW.org. We're going to be talking to folks who are providing these kinds of services throughout the next 3 weeks up to the holiday and the end of the season, just as a reminder of what's going on all year round, of course. And feel free to email us some suggestions for some of the groups you are paying attention to. And if we don't talk to those groups, we will definitely post some of those suggestions at our webpage, Weekday on KUOW, and on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. You can also go there or to our webpage for Nancy Pearl's list of books, her favorite books of 2012, though it might say best books of 2012. But either way, it'll be on Facebook. It'll be at KUOW.org after we check our spelling for all those different titles. Thank you. We will talk to you again tomorrow. Naomi Wolf will be here. She'll be talking about the female anatomy. We'll talk to her about that. Do join us.
Good morning. It's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News next.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Black Nativity this December 6th through the 23rd at the Moore Theater. Black Nativity features the poetry of Langston Hughes, the Nativity Band, and guest star B.B. Winans December 21st through the 23rd. Tickets at stgpresents.org.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from All-Wheel Drive Auto, independent Subaru repair and maintenance on the east side, now offering winterizing services. More information about all offerings is online at allwheeldriveauto.com, helping drivers get more from their Subarus.
We have clouds and rain, 48 degrees in the U District.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.